This time I'd like to take the opportunity of introducing our forum speaker for us today. Brother James H. Quigley is the Chief Executive Officer of Deloitte Touche and Tohmatsu, as I mentioned. Throughout his 34 years with the organization, Brother Quigley has taken on a number of leadership roles and built a distinguished track record of service to many multinational clients. As I was visiting with Brother Quigley today, he mentioned to me in that he'll be leaving for China this evening and tomorrow. We'll go to San Francisco this evening and be headed to China, and talked about the growth of their company in China over the last few years. Brother Quigley received the Heart of Gold Award in 2007, which acknowledges chief executives who have built volunteerism into their strategic business plans. He's also the U.S. co-chairman of the Transatlantic Business Dialogue and a member of the Board of Trustees of the U.S. Council for International Business and the German Marshall Fund. He's also a member of the Council on Competitiveness and served on the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission Advisory Committee on the Improvement to Financial Reporting. Brother Quigley is also involved in various business and community groups in the United States, including the Board of Trustees of Catalyst, the Financial Accounting Foundation, Japan Society, and the Economic Club of New York. His membership include the Business Roundtable and National Advisory Committee for BYU. Brother Quigley earned a bachelor's degree of science from Utah State University and has awarded an honorary doctorate degrees from Utah State University and from Bentley College. Brother Quigley's service in the church has included service as a bishop on the Stake High Council, Stake and Ward Young Men's President, Stake and Ward Executive Secretary and War Clerk and Scoutmaster. He presently serves as an instructor in the High Priest Quorum in the New Canaan, Connecticut Ward. He and his wife, Bonnie, were high school sweethearts and have been married for 38 years. They have 3 children and currently have 13 grandchildren.
Well, Brother Broadhead, thank you very much for that introduction. And to all of you, I appreciate you being willing to give up a few minutes of your time this afternoon. I certainly hope that 45 minutes from now, you're not going to feel like you've wasted it. I'm going to work hard to try to get to that outcome, or at least I've worked hard up to this point. But I appreciate the privilege of being here very much, and I'm honored to be part of this BYU-Idaho Business Summit. I had hoped that my wife Bonnie was going to be able to join me, but she unfortunately came down with a little bit of flu, and she just isn't ready to travel. She was concerned that her coughing would be distractive. I actually love being with her, and it would be okay with me, even her coughing, but you might not have enjoyed it as much, perhaps. I'm not sure. And you owe a great debt to my children. They have informed me that I'm not uproariously funny and that it would be good if I just kept my humor out of my efforts to try to actually deliver a message. And so you do owe them a thanks. And if you know any of my children, you can one day say thank you to them. I enjoyed the privilege last Saturday evening to attend the President's Banquet in Salt Lake City and to have the privilege of hearing directly from President Clark, as well as from President Eyring, on the exciting progress and what is really unfolding here and what you're very much a part of. And whenever I visit a client, I always, as I get myself briefed and ready, I read the CEO's letter to his shareholders. I like to understand what's important to that CEO. I read their external communications. And so in coming here, I spent some time on your webpage, and I read with great interest the inaugural address that President Clark delivered. And I was impressed when he talked about those 3 imperatives of substantially improving quality, serving more students, and reducing the relative cost of education. And what impressed me even more was then, almost 4 years later, in Salt Lake City at the banquet last Saturday night, behind him on 3 lovely panels were those same 3 imperatives. You're very fortunate to have President Clark here. I know many business executives, and I will tell you without equivocating that business executives who focus and then stay on message for multiple years make a huge difference, as I know he is making here. Bonnie and I grew up in Utah, and we always look forward to the privilege of returning to the Western United States. In my conference room in New York City, if you were to come to an office, to a meeting in my office, you would see a wide, beautiful picture of a western aspen forest. And on another wall, you would see a snow-covered pine tree with a number of bald eagles perched on its branches, and you would wonder if you were in New York City, perhaps. And then if you looked at the third wall, what you would see is a large and beautiful picture of the Great Lawn in Central Park in New York City. I believe that the contrast of those images tells you a little bit about who I am, and I am happy in New York City. I love New York City. I love Deloitte. I love the people of Deloitte. But I also know who I am, and I know where I'm from, and those roots and those values have served me very well. And I will tell you that the things that I learned as a young boy in rural southern Utah and the things that I learned as a young student at Utah State served me very well as the leader of one of the largest professional services firms in the world. Those values give me confidence to be able to stand in the wind that any business climate will bring. And by knowing who I am and knowing how I think, and it influences very dramatically how I lead. Now, I speculate that some of you are anxious about today's economy and that many of you might have some concern that you're going to be entering the job market at a challenging time. And for many in this economy, I believe the dominant emotion for them is fear. And I believe that fear frames how they think, it frames how they behave in the marketplace, and it also frames how they fundamentally are making decisions or how they see the world. And I believe that notion, that dominant emotion of fear, helps to explain a little bit about how the economy is performing today as it struggles under the immense weight of uncertainty and the challenge of adapting to a contracting credit market. Well, I understand that anxiety, and I also recognize that some of the changes happening today are quite unsettling to all of us. And you will likely know someone who has been very directly impacted by this downturn. And you also, as you would watch the media, see these stories played out 24 hours a day. And it certainly can bombard you with what these predictions are as we simply watch that information continue to flow. What I would like to do in my few minutes today is try to add a little bit of balance to that alarming tone and that voice that we seem to hear consistently that might be at times almost feel overwhelming. I became a partner with Deloitte in 1985. And I had the privilege at that time of working directly for the CEO of the firm as a brand new admitted partner. And one of the first responsibilities I had was to assist in planning for our annual partners meeting. Now, I was a little bit concerned about my ability to actually add value in that process because I'd never attended a partners meeting. And so I began my homework. And I read the leadership speeches that were delivered at the prior year's partners meeting in 1984. And then I went back in five-year intervals because I wanted to get a sense of how do these meetings run? What really happens? What are we trying to accomplish at these events? So I read the leadership speeches in 79 and in 74 and in 1969. And then I was a little bit, frankly, surprised as a bright-eyed 33-year-old that the consistent theme in those meetings, which today I'm sure all of you look at me and see this old man standing in front of you and think, why is he talking to me about 1969? That was a very long time ago, 40 years ago. But here's the insight. The consistent theme in those meetings in 69 and in 74 and in 79 and in 84, and I will tell you as I plan my world meeting for 2009, the consistent theme is change. And as a 33-year-old, I came to the conclusion that the only constant in business is change. And what I think happens to us today is the label that we might attach to the nature of the change that is going on might change from time to time, but the actual existence of change does not, in fact, ever leave, certainly, the business world that we're in. It's a dynamic environment for sure, But I believe it is a dynamic environment that is filled with opportunities for those who are able to adapt. We've seen change before, and with every change, I believe there is both challenge and there's opportunity. And it's only a matter of state of mind in terms of which dimension of that change we choose to focus on. I urge you, and it's easy for me to say, and it's hard to do, but I urge you to try to replace fear, if that is in fact one of the dominant emotions in your mind and thinking as you look forward. I'd urge you to replace that with confidence. And now let me try to make the case for that. I think the struggle between fear and confidence drives not only market behavior, but it also influences our personal behaviors. And when we feel fear, we struggle to see a brighter future. We disconnect from the world and can become almost dysfunctional. We focus on our inadequacies rather than our strengths. And when we replace fear with confidence, we're replacing pessimism with hope. And we begin to envision a future and plan for that future and focus on what's possible. Whether you're entering a new profession or making a personal transition, I encourage you to proceed with confidence in who you are and in the values that you can bring. Having a quiet confidence in who I am has served me well during times of enormous turbulence. I believe that it will help you too, and that your inner core strength will enable you to withstand the strongest gusts of wind. I believe in the power of stories, and for a number of years, I've used storytelling as a way to build culture at Deloitte. I regularly share stories on my blog to connect with 165,000 colleagues around the world. I also share stories and experiences with partners when I have the opportunity to meet with them and exchange views. With that idea in mind, let me share a few stories with you about important moments and people that taught me invaluable life's lessons. Lessons that have shaped who I am today. Lessons that have instilled in me the confidence to face the most challenging obstacles. I've organized my comments around three broad themes and included stories to illustrate my key points. The themes are, first, leadership. Second, what does it take to successfully launch a career? And then finally, concluding with the idea of having both a career and a life. Now, first, leadership. I enjoyed reading President Clark's comments on leadership with a lowercase L. The demonstration of leadership is essential for success in many dimensions of our lives, certainly at home, in the community, in the classroom, and as I'm sure many of you have experienced on a mission, or many of you that will experience those other dimensions of your life. And I think leadership, in fact, is relevant for and important for success in each of those dimensions. When I began to conduct leadership sessions with my partners, I had an advisor who was assisting me in those sessions, and she urged me to decide what I really believed about leadership, to do some hard work to understand why do I believe that, and then to do the final piece of hard work and to actually write it down. It seemed like a modest request to me, and then I was surprised that it required over 6 months to complete to my satisfaction. Now, generally, when we say leader or leadership, many of us have an image that comes to mind of an iconic leader in a field that is important to us, whether in politics, military, religion, sports, whatever is important to you. When you hear the word leader, you might identify with someone that you label as an iconic leader. When I speak to my partners, I urge them to think of themselves when they hear the word leader, and then to step up to those expectations. I do not want them to engage in a leadership discussion, and you can appreciate this with 8,000 partners, why I wouldn't want this, but I don't want them thinking about leadership and thinking about me and what Jim should do as our leader. And it is enormously more powerful if I can get them to engage on leadership and think about them. And then just think about the power and the impact you can have in an organization if you have 8,000 people elevate their performance as leaders and step up to what is really truly possible. And I believe that is the essence of what I am seeking to accomplish and what I believe is one of the reasons that we've been able to move forward successfully. I take no credit whatsoever to try to say we were the fastest growing professional services firm last year. Oh, what a good boy am I, and what a great job I'm doing as a leader. But rather, what a terrific group of partners we have. What an impressive collection of talent and their ability to team and to focus on delivering value to their clients and then be paid fairly for the value that has been delivered. That's what it's all about. And so leadership, I want to try to urge you in the few minutes that I spend talking about that subject today to also be willing to think about you when you hear the word leader rather than thinking about that iconic leader that you have in your mind. It isn't about Winston Churchill. He was a great leader. It isn't about Colin Powell. He was a great leader. It is about you, because you have it within yourself, the ability to be a great leader in any of those dimensions of your life that are important to you. And that's why I believe it is possible for us to truly replace fear with confidence when you get in touch with who you are and the strength of that core and the value that that then provides to you. Well, what is a leader? What is the one thing that distinguishes a leader from all others? At its most fundamental level, I believe a leader is someone who has followers. And when I speak about leadership, I focus all of my energy on followership. If followership is required, what are the attributes of a follower? I believe followers are individuals who are loyal to a leader, and a follower shares a common goal, purpose, or objective that they're willing to work with that leader to seek to achieve. And then if we just continue on that logic, then how does one obtain followers? And in my view, this is the most fundamental question in any leadership discussion. And again, in my view, first and most importantly, a leader must treat others with respect. Each of us has some fundamental human needs, as important as food, clothing, and shelter. We don't focus on it necessarily regularly, and we may not even be completely in touch with it. But I will tell you that your need to be respected, your need to be valued, and your need to be appreciated is as important to you as your need for food, clothing, and shelter. I learned this lesson from my father. My father was a forester. He had someone who worked for him as a foreman, and his name was Rex Hutchison. And Rex was born with a speech impediment, and he spoke with a very pronounced lisp. One night at dinner, I decided to entertain the family. I had five brothers and sisters, and so you can imagine the scene, the dinner table, all eight of the Quigleys gathered around the dinner table, and little Jimmy decides that he was going to provide the entertainment. And so I gave my very best Rex Hutchison imitation. And my sisters twittered a little bit, "Oh, isn't Jimmy a funny little boy?" But my father didn't smile. And he didn't laugh. He simply looked at me and said, "Jimmy, you don't understand or appreciate all that Rex does for the Forest Service and how important he is to me." The entertainment was over. I discovered something about my dad. If you were Rex Hutchison, you would walk through a wall for my dad. Rex was loyal to my dad. There was nothing my dad would ask of Rex that he would not do and would not do to the very best of his ability. I observed that as a young boy and once naively thought that that loyalty was the result of position, that because my father was the ranger, the foreman was loyal to the ranger. That's just simply the way it was. But experience and reflection have taught me that Rex was loyal to my dad because my dad provided him with respect. How many people in Rex's circle treated him the way my dad treated him? probably a very short list. I am sure that speech impediment that Rex carried with him his entire life made him the target of many jokes, but never from my dad. Treat others with respect, and you can be an effective member of a team. Treat others with respect, and they'll follow you. You can be a leader. Treat others with respect, and you can sell products or services. Treat others with respect, and they will reciprocate. I've watched some enormously talented people fall very far short of their potential because they did not learn this one simple lesson that I think each one of us can take into our core. Just one more brief, or 2 points to just simply try to drive that home to this audience. Some lessons that we should have learned when we were 9 or 10 years old, we have to relearn. When Bonnie and I were a young married couple at Utah State, we would entertain other married couples at our home sometimes on particular evenings. And I remember one night we had 3 or 4 couples over to play some board games and just enjoy some light food. And I decided that I was going to provide the entertainment by, you know, making a few jokes in the direction of things that Bonnie did that weren't exactly the same way that my mother did them, and oh, wasn't that funny. And I'm sure you can all kind of appreciate what happened when the last couple was dismissed from our house. And I relearned a lesson that I shouldn't have had to relearn, but Bonnie and I signed a pact that night that we would never make each other the point of entertainment by making fun of one another when we were entertaining others. And I will tell you with some pride that I've been faithful to that. And now, the analog to you. Imagine that you're in a study group, and one member of your study group happens to not be there, and someone in the group decides it's time to provide entertainment to the entire group by making fun of that individual absent. What is everyone else thinking in that circle? And what is the likelihood of the voice of that ridicule actually ever enjoying the respect of everyone in the circle? Treat others with respect. It'll make a huge difference. It's fundamentally simple, but unbelievably important. A leader also seeking followers must demonstrate a genuine care and interest in each team member. For those of us that lived through 9/11, it was a gripping day. For me, a before and after event by which I measure time in my business career. Things that I accomplished before 9/11, and then things that I did after 9/11, a before and after event. I will use up all of my time if I got started, so I'll try to be brief. When we left the World Financial Center, 100 feet from ground zero, and headed to set up our command center, we moved to Parsippany. And the only thing that I asked our HR leader to bring with us, because when I got to the Jersey City office, we still had power there, I asked Charlie to print out the listing of our 3,500 people by Responsibility Center with all of the contact information that we could get on them. And then when we got to the Parsippany office, because I'd recorded a message on our emergency broadcast network and told the partners to assemble in Parsippany, anyone that could get to Parsippany to come to Parsippany. And then we took that list of 3,500 and just simply divided it into a list of 20 and 25. And then to each partner, I simply gave that list and said, the only thing I care about and the only thing I want you focused on is finding these 25 people and finding out if they have any particular needs and offer to be of help and then give them some direction in terms of what we're going to be providing for them here in Parsippany. And then one of my partners, Mark Loazzo, shared with me this experience a few days later. He had found 24 of his 25, and when you lose your cell phone towers on the top of the World Trade Center, when you lose your phone switch that actually controlled all of our phones in the tri-state area, in an effort to drive down cost, we put a single switch into the World Financial Center, so we lost all of our phones in the New York area. And then when we evacuated the World Financial Center, we walked away from all of our laptops. So imagine now trying to find 3,500 people without a landline, without cell phones, and without an email system that we had relied on. So Mark Loazo, we had voicemail restored about 24, 48 hours later out of our Hermitage office. But Mark told me that he was on the New Jersey Turnpike heading home late and was clearing voicemail, and he picked up a message from his number 25. And he said he was so overcome with emotion that he had to pull off the road to recompose himself to then continue on his way home. But if you want to be a leader, show people that you have a genuine care and interest in them. And I pride myself in that tone at Deloitte. And I will tell you how I felt after Katrina when we got Karen West, one of the EAs, off of the upper level of her parents' home because her parents would not evacuate New Orleans. And when the water got up to over the first floor, they couldn't get off of that upper level. And we had a raft and chainsaws ready to go in and cut through that roof and get Karen and her parents out. And Karen's brother beat us to it. But I was in Houston when we had our Welcome to Houston reception for all of our colleagues in New Orleans. And I'll never forget what one of the senior accountants said to me when he came up. He said, "Jim, I will never leave Deloitte unless you fire me after the way that you've taken care of us. It's unbelievable. You have moved us from New Orleans. You've settled us in Houston. You've taken care of every imaginable detail. And my wife's employer hasn't even placed the first call yet to her. But it does make a difference. And I am proud of my team." Within 60 minutes of a U.S. Airways plane landing on the Hudson River that I could see out my office window, within 60 minutes, I knew I had one colleague on that flight. And I was able to communicate with them through email to say how delighted I was that they were safe and if there was anything that we could do to take care of him while he was working overnight to get back to his home in the Carolinas. And tragically, when a plane goes down in Buffalo, New York, within 1 hour, I know that I have a colleague on that flight. And we are able to handle and manage all of the challenge associated with that family directly, and I think dramatically better than could the airlines at those tragic times. Another requirement to followership is integrity, and without it, your team will not give their very best. And I will tell you that in this marketplace, you cannot win if you do not have the very best from your team. The best is not good enough. You have to have their very best to find that winning edge. And the only way a leader is going to be able to obtain that very best from that team is if everyone on the team, as they look up at that leader, they believe that is a person of integrity. I will tell you that the highest compliment that I have ever received was following the implosion of the Anderson firm. We were working aggressively to recruit the top Anderson partners in New York, as were other professional services firms. And I was later told by the leader of that practice that the way that the Anderson partners described me was, if you have an offer from Quigley, go to the bank with it, and then the compliment, because he's a man of his word. And I believe that's what we should each seek to be in business, is known as and characterized as a man of your word. It was interesting to me, I was in Saudi Arabia 2 months ago at a competitiveness conference, and we were talking about reputation. And one of the leaders made a very compelling point that painted an image in my mind that helped me understand this. And he said, "You build a reputation at the pace that a coconut tree grows, and you can destroy it at the pace that a coconut falls from that tree." Integrity matters. Do not step across that line, because you will have it'll take a long time to regrow that coconut tree. Leaders also must have an optimistic and a can-do attitude. There's some excellent examples from history of leaders who I think demonstrated what that really means in terms of their ability to convey hope, their ability to have vision, their ability to have some sense of direction. When I visit the war museums in London, where Churchill was during the siege that the UK was under at the time of World War II, it's amazing when you think about the impact that he had on the actions and the thinking of the British people by his ability to communicate his never-give-up message. And also this story of Shackleton. I love the leadership lessons from Shackleton's story when he was on that journey to Antarctica and his ship became icebound. I believe without his ability to convey hope and them, his men, to be able to hold on to that, there's no way they would have survived those many dark winter months. And so the analog, I think, is easy. Imagine that you're in a case study competition and the leader walks in and says to the team as you're beginning to work, "I've read this case study and I think it's ridiculous. And I don't think there's any way we can come up with any coherent thinking in terms of what we might advise or recommend." And now compete in a case study competition with another team where the leader walks in and says, "I've read the case study. I think it's fascinating. And I think there's some very interesting angles we can explore. And I think we're going to have some fun on the journey." Now, which of those teams is going to emerge? And which one of those leaders is truly going to have some followership? That sense of optimism is essential. And then finally, delivering results, and delivering results consistently. In addition to respecting others, demonstrating this genuine interest in caring, having integrity, the ability to communicate hope, you also have to deliver on your commitments in order to really truly enjoy followership, in my view. I could go on, when I'm with my partners, my lecture, I don't like that term, but my discussion on leadership goes for a very long time with lots of case studies, which I'm not going to burden you with today. I want to move to the second part of what I want to share some perspective with you on, and that is this whole idea of how do you successfully launch a career? And when I go through my list of what it is that is needed to successfully launch a career and make a positive beginning, it'll come as no surprise to you that I believe the five essential elements that are needed to obtain followership are also needed if you want to successfully launch a career. Because I believe in careers, the difference is always made by your ability to work as a team and by your ability to be a team member. And I will tell you, you will not be a successful team member if you do not show respect to your teammates. And you'll be a dramatically more effective team member if you have a genuine interest in caring for each of the members of your team. And that can-do attitude is important. And the ability to really deliver results and honor those commitments is essential to successfully launch a career. I'll add four items to my list. First impressions matter. Second, a view that I hold very strongly, life is filled with opportunities, not entitlements. Third, a never give up attitude. And then fourth, draw strength from your network. Let's examine each of these one at a time. First of all, first impressions matter. When you walk into a room, and when I'm coaching a pursuit team and we're on an effort to try to win a very large project, I try to get each member of my team to really understand how critical this is. When you walk in the room, a judgment's going to be made in the first 10 seconds before one word is spoken. Create momentum for yourself by how you appear, how you're groomed, the presence that you carry. Your shoes are polished. You're willing to make eye contact. Your heels are not worn out. Your clothes are pressed. It may not matter to you, and you may think it doesn't matter to your peers, but it might matter to someone who's hiring you, and it might matter to someone who might be paying for your skills and talent. Look the part. First impressions matter as you begin a career. Second, life is filled with opportunities, not entitlements. Although embarrassing to me now, I want to share with you some thinking that I demonstrated at the time I accepted my first opportunity to move to New York City to join the research department at Deloitte. I was 27 years old, and I went there with an attitude that was something like this. "I'm Jim Quigley from Salt Lake City. I have a strong academic record. My clients have been trying to hire me, and I've decided to stay with Deloitte. Give me a great experience." Now, I was just a little boy. I was 27 years old, and I'd spent the whole of my life in Utah. And what I believed about New Yorkers was life was pretty good for a New Yorker. They didn't work as hard as people in Salt Lake City. They showed up at 9 o'clock, and they left at 5. And so I thought, what's not to like about this? I'm a newly promoted manager. I'm going to work 9 to 5. I'm going to qualify for a manager bonus. This is good. Of course, I'll go to New York. And so I caught the 7:50 train into the city. I knew I wanted to be at the office by 9, and I had every expectation of being on the 5:20 at night. And I worked that cadence for 3 weeks. And then we had a department meeting. And as managers, we later affectionately referred to this department meeting as Black Friday. Mike Sutton was the head of our department, and he spoke to us, and I felt like he was speaking directly to me. And he stated that some of the managers in the department didn't seem to understand what a unique opportunity we had been given to work in the national office on a 2-year assignment, and that that 2 years would pass very quickly, and if we didn't develop a more constructive attitude, we'd miss a tremendous opportunity. When I got on the train that night and headed home, I reflected on Mike's words, and they resonated strongly in my mind, and I chose to interpret it as if he was speaking directly to me. And what I decided as I rode the train in the following Monday was if I was going to have a terrific opportunity in the national office of Deloitte, it was going to be because I decided I wanted that opportunity and I went out to get it. It wasn't going to be because someone walked into my office with that opportunity on a silver platter and handed it to me. And I will tell you with some pride, and trying to not engage in boasting here, but just to try to make my point. 2 years later, all of the accounting and auditing partners in Deloitte rate all of the managers in the national office from 1 all the way down to the bottom. At the end of my 2-year assignment, I say with great pride that when they rated those 57 managers, I was the number one manager on that list. And I will tell you that that has created momentum for my career that I enjoy today. And I tell you without equivocating that had I not chased that entitlement thinking out of my head as a 27-year-old, there's no way you would have been interested in inviting me to be here to speak, because I would have been gone from Deloitte a very long time ago. And now the analog for each of you as students. There was a time in the labor market where things were very much out of balance, and the number of employers seeking highly talented fresh recruits from college campuses, there was certainly a far greater demand than there was supply. And that allowed perhaps bright, young, energetic people to sometimes walk into an office with a little bit of an entitlement attitude. I'll tell you, if you walk into an office today with an entitlement attitude, your time in that office is going to be quite brief. And the number of people looking for the opportunity that you might have landed is quite long. The opportunity set that is available to opportunity seekers is broad. The opportunity set that's available to entitlement thinkers is very narrow. If you have an entitlement attitude about what life owes you or what an employer owes you, you're going to miss some incredible opportunities, in my view. Number 3, if you want to successfully launch a career, have a never-give-up attitude. My father's mother died when he was 10, and he was essentially raised by his grandmother and his step-grandfather. His father was a forester and spent almost each week on the mountain in various remote guard stations and ranger stations. And the time that my father had with his father was very limited, and his father promised him that he would take him on the mountain 1 week with him if he would attend to his chores. And so my father, that week, obviously was very attentive to his chores. His father returned and knew that everything had been handled, and so they began their preparations for a week on the mountain together. They purchased the supplies, and on Monday morning, they saddled up their horses, and they loaded up the pack mule, and they headed up on the Manti La Salle Mountains near Moab. And after they had moved up the trail for a few miles, the trail forked, and my grandfather sent the pack mule on up the main trail, and my father and his father then headed off to ride the fence line, to follow up on the cattle, to attend on the other duties of on the forest that day. And my grandfather turned to my father and said, "Don't worry about the mule. He'll be standing at the gate at the Warner Ranger Station when we finish our work today. He's there every week." And so they continued about their duties. And at the end of the day, they headed to the Warner Ranger Station, no mule standing at the gate. My grandfather knew immediately that something must be wrong, and they began riding the main trail back down towards Moab. And after a couple of miles on the trail, they saw that a quaken asp had fallen across the trail and blocked the path. The mule had stepped off the trail and had tried to walk around that obstacle and came to two trees that were wide enough for the mule to fit through, but not for the packs. And when the mule then, those packs hit, the mule just simply stopped. And he stood there all day. And when my father and his father arrived, my grandfather jumped off his horse, went down, backed the mule up, walked him around the two trees, got him back up on the trail, and they headed up to the Warner Ranger Station. For almost all of our life, whenever one of either me or one of my siblings, whenever we hit an obstacle and it appeared we stopped trying, my father would say, "You're acting like a mule." And I'm certain that each of us will face obstacles, and they will be in your path as you pursue your goals. But I urge you to find a way around, find your way through, find your way over, find a way to keep moving forward. Do not act like a mule. And then finally, draw strength from your... I'm going to go really faster because I need to be respectful of the time. Draw strength from your network is a fourth way to really, truly, successfully launch a career. Let me just illustrate that with one very quick point. When my son Nate returned from his mission, we had moved from Connecticut to St. Louis at the time, so he came back to a market that he didn't know anyone, and he was concerned about trying to get productively employed, and he worked his network, including me, and I found an unpaid internship for him at Monsanto, and he researched in that internship the market opportunity for the bovine growth hormone for dairy herds in Latin America. And then when it came time to apply for a job and people were going through his resume, even though he was terrific at sealing driveways, even though he was terrific at maintaining yards, everyone that interviewed him wanted to talk about that Monsanto internship. And that network that we leveraged created the opportunity for him to begin that career. And I know that that repeats itself and will repeat it for you. As you pursue your career, do not be shy about leveraging your network. Almost 90% of the positions in this country get filled through networking. Work your network. It'll be enormously valuable to you. Let me close with just two last very quick thoughts. The first is, I think you could listen to someone like me, and you could look at him and say, boy, that guy looks like he is just too uniquely focused and perhaps even selfishly focused on his career. He's moved his family to New York, back to Salt Lake, to St. Louis, to New York, to St. Louis, to New York. What a selfish guy. I'm sure his children have been very, very poorly treated as a product of all of this. He must have no work-life balance. He must be just simply a career guy. And the thought that I want to replace that thought with is I don't like to talk about work-life balance, not because I don't think I have one. It's just that I think there's a better way of talking about that challenge. And the way that I like to express it is work-life integration. And I don't want to get home at night and then say, did my work win today or did my life win today? And I'm just constantly assessing a winner and a loser. And I'm always forced to be a loser in at least one of those equations. What I think is a dramatically more healthy thought is work-life integration. And instead of trying to balance your life, how about have a life? And how about have every dimension of your life support that life and then work together as a cohesive whole? I mentioned I wish Bonnie were here. She travels with me. The leaders of Deloitte love Bonnie. If you knew her, you would understand why. Sister Clark could easily explain this. She's dramatically nicer than me. And whenever I go to a world meeting and Bonnie's not with me, I get asked 20 or 30 times, Jim, where's Bonnie? We miss Bonnie. And then sometimes they say, Jim, we had this gift for Bonnie. Would you carry this, please carry this back to her? But she's a big part of the equation. She's a big part of who I am, as is my entire family. And I believe that we have that integrated life that I earlier referenced. And I would just try to illustrate it with one last point, and I am sensitive to the time. For those of you with a 3 o'clock class, just walk fast. I'm sure you'll be able to make it. I was 33 years old when I became the secretary to our board and the secretary to our operating committee. I will tell you that to understand how to plan an agenda, to manage the advanced materials, to manage the meeting, to follow up on the action items behind that meeting, they don't necessarily get built as the senior manager on the Monsanto audit. But I will tell you that you can build those skills as an executive secretary to a stake president. You can build those skills as a ward clerk to a bishop. And much of what I've learned about administration, much of what I've learned about those activities, I learned through church service. And one more time, I believe I have an integrated life. Each dimension is supporting the others. And the momentum that I created for myself as a 33-year-old who actually understood how to conduct a meeting made a huge difference. Finally, let me just close with just one last thought that is dramatically more important than anything else that I've said, and that is to successfully launch a career, to successfully enjoy a leadership position and to leverage that opportunity, the most important thing you can do is to be humble and to pray always. I know you're familiar with that counsel. I know what I believe David did as he tended his flock and found strength and confidence to challenge a lion and a bear. And I also know what Amulek taught in Alma 34 about praying over your flocks and your fields. One of the trappings of CEO-hood that I have allowed myself to have is the CEO has a private bathroom. And that can be a closet for you. And I will tell you that I believe that a boy from Kanosh, Utah, a town of 350 people, could have the privilege one day of leading one of the largest professional services firms in the world if you will be humble and if you will pray always. And when I step up onto the stage and I'm speaking to 4,000 partners in front of me, you can feel the confidence that comes as the Holy Ghost bears witness to you that what it is that you've prepared and what it is that you've worked hard to deliver, you will deliver. Good luck to all of you. This is an exciting time. I want you to replace that sense of fear with a sense of confidence. And I want you to replace that sense of fear with confidence because you know who you are and you know what it takes to actually be a leader. And it isn't rocket science. It's some very fundamental things that you've been taught all your life by people around you. And that will enable you to, I believe, be anything that you want to be. Thank you very much.
We express our appreciation to Brother Quigley for his counsel and direction to us. We'll take about a 10-minute break, and we'll start the question and answer session. Those who'd like to participate, if you'd move towards the front. We also remind you of the reception at 3:30. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and start the question and answer session right now. My name is Jared Smart. I've been asked to conduct this portion of the event. I just wanted to announce, reminder that the reception will be held at 3:30 in the Taylor Cultural Hall. We'll go ahead and take questions until 3:25, at which point we'll need to close up so that we can go to the reception. If you have a question, please be sure to come to one of these microphones located in the front, and Brother Quigley will call upon you. Thank you.
Okay, guys, you better have some questions, or otherwise you'll be destined to hear some more stories that you've probably heard all the stories from me you want to hear. So how about some questions? And I would also say thank you to Jared for his kindness in picking me up at the airport last night and trying to keep me under control here today. So please.
I was just hoping you could expound a little bit more on, I guess, integrating your family life along with your career.
Okay, very good. I'm happy to take that. Let me try to explain where that thought came from. Did everybody hear the question? It was, could I expound on this whole notion of an integrated life as opposed to a balanced life, which is the paradigm that I think we many times use to try to describe that. When I was 27 years old, we moved to New York, and I didn't realize, as I've acknowledged, that New Yorkers work harder than anyone on the planet. There's no one who works harder than New Yorkers. No one. I travel unmercifully, and I've been in many, many cities and many countries. I've never seen anyone who works harder than New Yorkers. And when I decided to change my mind and try to take advantage of the opportunity that I had, I would catch a 6 a.m. train instead of an 8:20 train. And I would catch sometimes the 7 o'clock train, sometimes the 8 o'clock train, sometimes the 9 o'clock train to get home. And we had a young family. And what that meant was, on Friday night, when I would get on the train and head home, I was really heading home. But I hadn't really seen the little guys Monday through Friday, because I was gone before they were up, and I was home many times when they were bedded down. And so what we did was, Saturday just became project morning. We would work in the yard from 8 until 12, and then from 12 until 6, we just did things together as a family. And we discovered as a family the East Coast, which is a fantastic place to live, wonderful places to discover. And we obviously managed our church callings on Sunday. But I got to the point where I just believed that that was okay. And so instead of torturing myself Monday through Friday that, boy, I'm out of balance, I decided that I have an integrated life. I'm going to provide for the family. I have an enormously capable spouse. And she took care of the home front Monday through Friday. And then Saturday and Sunday, we were together. And we instilled some important traditions. And I did interview my children. We have our second home in Park City. I've got a son in Florida. I've got a son in California and a daughter in Arizona. And we're in Connecticut. So we use Park City as a gathering place when we have vacations. But I interviewed my children. I looked them right in the eye. And I said, do you feel that you were disadvantaged in any way as a product of the intensity of the career experience that we had and the many moves? And all three of them, to a person, says, Dad, absolutely not. You were at our baseball games. You were at our swim meets. You were at the concerts when we were performing. You were always there for us. And they had in their mind this mental image that I was always there, even though I allowed myself to have in my mind that I was never there. And somehow it just simply became this integrated, functioning life where each dimension of my life complements the other, and it became an integrated whole. And I didn't go through each day trying to award a winner and a loser to one dimension of my life or another. And that's the thought that I like to try to chase out and try to replace with that idea of this integrated life. The weekly planning paradigm became an integrated life for me. My church service fit in that. When I was a scoutmaster, I felt that I was both doing my community service, I was doing my church service, and I was also acting as a father, because I had the privilege of having in my troop one of my sons. And again, I think each dimension of my life complemented the other, and it became an integrated whole. Please.
Hi, my name is Pash. I'm an accounting major.
Good for you, a noble profession.
Yeah. I'm trying to find accounting internship, and I know you're in the law and touch, and I know it's a big four firm. In a lot of students, they would like to get into. Would you have something suggestion for me? I'm from Thailand, and it's really hard because international students, a lot of companies, they're not hiring right now. And the second question is, I know you work in New York City. Do you have to work on Sunday too? So thank you.
That's a great question. Let's take the last piece of that first. On the Sunday dimension of it, when I was a bishop, I was the leader of our tri-state practice and then later the U.S. CEO and also a bishop. And I just decided that Sundays and the New Canaan Ward functioned better if I was there than if I wasn't there. And so everybody just knew that on Sunday, if you need something from Jim, you better get it from him. Monday through Friday is your highest probability of actually accomplishing it. You might catch him on Saturday morning, maybe, but you'll never find him on Sunday. And then if there was ever a real emergency, then I would, you know, manage the Sunday, but I don't let meetings get scheduled on Sunday. And I try to avoid Monday morning meetings that require Sunday travel. In my current global role, not everybody in the world has the same day as their day of worship. And when you go to Asia, it's a hike. And many times the weekend travel is required. But one of the other things about New Yorkers, I love New Yorkers, by the way. The experiences that I had with them on 9/11 just has me bonded to them in a way that I think of myself as a New Yorker. Most of my career has been there. But almost all of those New York offices where the lights go on early and they go off late, they generally don't go on Saturday, and they generally don't go on Sunday. And it's just because of the difficulty of the commute. If you've got a 1 hour and 10 minute commute from Connecticut, you're not going to ride the train for an hour and a half to go do 3 hours worth of work. If you're living in St. Louis, and my office at Monsanto is 10 minutes away, you know, you jump in the car and you drive 10 minutes and you work there part of Saturday. But the weekend dimension in New York is just simply culturally, you just simply don't go to the office. Many people work at home, get some things done on Saturday and so forth, but generally not in the office. Now, in terms of finding an internship, I think this is fantastic what's been done here, and I just complimented President Clark on the program that's been developed, but that's what you need to do, is just simply work with your network here to get that done. And the fact that there is this web and this network of missionaries whose role it is to find internships for University of Idaho students. Wow, fantastic. Work that network. Internships are, and especially summer internships at Deloitte, they're hard to get, really hard to get. We provide them to graduate students that we are aggressively interested in recruiting. And we use our internships as a recruiting tool. And you need to cause us to conclude that we very badly want your services, that we want you to be one of us far more than we want to see you working for one of our competitors. And that's hard to do. We hired last year over 40,000 people. This year we'll hire over 30,000 people. One way you can look at that is Deloitte is still hiring. Deloitte is still in the marketplace. That's terrific, and that's true. Another way you can look at that if you want to is it's 25% harder to get a job at Deloitte than it was a year ago. And I'm going to work harder. And what I say to people when they are looking for a job, and what I say to people when they, perhaps if they've lost a job, your pursuit of a position needs to be as intense and require as much of your time as would be required if you had the job. So if you had a job and you're going to spend 60 hours a week delivering value to your employer working, I think you have to work 60 hours a week to find a job. You have to give it everything that you have. You can't presume anyone's going to do anything for you. And you can't ignore your network. You've got to try to get everyone trying to do something for you. But you have to hustle. I watched my son Nate when he got his internship and when he got his first position. I mean, unbelievable. And when he got admitted to business school, I'd never seen someone so focused, so intense, and work so aggressively. And that's why I am so fond of my chase entitlement thinking out of your head. You cannot afford the thought of, I am an accounting student at the University of Idaho. I am entitled to an internship from anyone I want an internship from. That's part of the entitlement of being an accounting student at the University of Idaho. Chase that thought out of your head. Replace it with, I'm a student at the University of Idaho. With that capability and this network, I have an opportunity to compete, to find myself an internship. And I'm going to go compete for that opportunity. And if the door of opportunity opens for me, including if it's a boy from southern Utah who's invited to move to New York, I'm going to ask myself the question, where can I learn the most in the next 2 years? And if it is accepting that assignment to move to New York with a wife who has also never been east of Colorado, when the door of opportunity opens, walk through it and take advantage of those opportunities, but chase that entitlement thinking out of your head. You are not entitled to an internship as a result of being a student here. Now replace it with, I have an opportunity to compete to obtain an internship because I'm a student at the University of Idaho. Dramatically healthier thought. And then go to work to find it. And there's more than four people who can provide it. These four firms are special firms. I'm not objective about it after having spent 35 years of my career there. But in the United States, there are 350,000 CPAs. Of those 350,000 CPAs in the United States, there's probably 30,000 of them work for a big four firm. If accounting is your passion, there's lots of opportunity. Other questions? Please.
I was just going to say, ask, as we work on these skills that you've talked about today, how do we communicate those in an interview to get our internship or start a job? Even as we develop these skills, we have a short amount of time in our resume and in our interview to communicate those, and what's the best way to do that?
First of all, get some advice from people who have actually been through an interview. And then say to them, would you be willing to give me a mock interview? And then think very carefully, if you have 30 minutes with me, you have 30 minutes with me to convince me that I should be trying to knock down doors to hire you. And there's a fine line to walk. I mean, if you are too brash, and I come to the conclusion, I don't think that he's going to fit at Deloitte with that style, then you're not going to win. And that's why I think, and I try to really emphasize this idea of confidence from your core, confidence in who you are. And when you walk into that interview, if you believe in who you are, and if you believe that you have a value proposition to offer, and if you think you have some relevant skills, find the way to communicate that. When I was graduating from college, I had my brother advise me, he says, Jim, make sure the first interview that you accept is not with someone you want to work for, because you're probably not going to do very well in that first interview. Now, what you can do to overcome that is have a mock interview with someone who's in your network, someone that you respect, someone that can help you think about how you want to present yourself. Spend some time doing some homework. Figure out something about the enterprise. Figure out why you think your skills would actually complement and fit well there. And then when you walk into that interview and you start putting forward your value proposition and start trying to convince me that in China, just to use the example in China, we receive 25,000 resumes for the 900 people we're going to make an offer to. Now, how are you going to distinguish yourself in that stack of 25,000 resumes? How are you going to become one of those that I decide I want to interview? And then if you become one of the 2,000 that I decide I want to interview, how are you going to become one of the 1,000 that I decide I'm going to make an offer to? And you just have to think that one all the way through. But try to understand Deloitte. Try to understand something about who we are, just to use that as an example, or any employer. What do they value? Are those values aligned with your values? Do you believe that you could be an effective contributor there? And then find a way to market that in those 30 minutes. And try to find a way to market it in a way that isn't going to be, you'll learn, you'll play off of your interviewer. But be yourself and be confident in who you are. And if you walk into that interview where your dominant emotion is fear, I'm walking in and I'm afraid I'm not going to do well. I'm walking in and I'm afraid I'm not going to get an offer. I'm walking in with my head down and I sort of back in apologetically, boy, I'm sorry, Mr. Interviewer, for, taking up your time today, hoping that there's an opportunity for me here someplace. I've worked hard with my school stuff and
I think if you know, if there's anything that you could do for me, I'd really appreciate it. You know what would happen when you finished. And then just think of the contrast of somebody who walks in and they look that interviewer right in the eye and they shake hands with confidence. And you sit down knowing that you have market-relevant skills that you want to have the privilege of selling. And instead of allowing fear to be the dominant emotion that is evident on your expression, on the way in which you carry yourself, you instead have confidence. Not arrogance, confidence. You can come through those interviews and you can do it well, but you have to believe in yourself. And the only point I tried to make in my earlier 40 minutes was you have something very special. And you've been taught, and you have a suite of experiences that is very unique. And if you be yourself, and you decide that my dominant emotion is going to be confidence, you can sell yourself in a 30-minute interview. But if you walk into that interview with a dominant emotion of fear, I can virtually assure you what the letter's going to say when you receive it 5 days later. I could dictate the letter to you right now if you walk into that interview with fear. It's a tough market out there, for sure. But it just, the way that you need to think about it is, boy, I'm going to work harder. And I'm confident and I'm definitely willing to distinguish myself by what I'm willing to demonstrate I'm capable of doing as I compete for this job. And walk into the interview with that attitude. And you'll convince me that, boy, I'd like to have you part of the Deloitte team. I hope helpful. There was a question over here, please.
As a world business leader, I wanted to ask you, do you think that the United States is still the land of opportunity when you compare to China and other places like that have had booming economies, especially in the light of the recent recession? Should I be learning Mandarin and looking for jobs over there? Or are you thinking about relocating your company there maybe sometimes in the distant future?
I have a bunch of my partners in China would love me to move my headquarters there. And I have 10,000 people in China right now. And we're definitely recruiting in China. My priority markets, where I'm investing and expecting to have growth that is disproportionate to the growth we'll enjoy in other markets, are China, India, Russia, but I've put that on the side burner right now, Brazil, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. And I believe that we're going to have superior growth there. Now, do I believe that the U.S. is still the land of opportunity? I absolutely believe that. And what I also believe, and believe with passion, that it is good that this economy is diversifying. And if you looked at a chart, it's a fascinating chart. If you have the x-axis be time and the y-axis be GDP per capita, and what you see is the U.S. sits on top back, 30 or 40 years ago with a really big gap down to the next countries. And then as you trace that forward, what you see is those Western economies start to converge at the GDP per capita that the U.S. enjoys. And I think that's a terrific thing. And I will tell you, without equivocating, without the Marshall Plan, that would have never happened. And the U.S. enabled the recovery of, why do you think, here's the largest economies of the world, the U.S., number two, Japan, number three, Germany. Now, what do you think the three largest economies in the world would be had the U.S. not had the Marshall Plan and had not invested in rebuilding Japan and rebuilding Germany? My Belgian partners almost get emotional when I speak to them because the Belgians love the Americans, and the Belgians know what the U.S. did. And I think it's terrific that GDP per capita in Belgium or GDP per capita in Germany or in the U.K. or in France is right up there with the U.S. That's terrific. And GDP per capita in China is down at about $2,500 as opposed to $40,000 in the U.S. Do I think that China is going to move that curve up? Yes, I do. And what is happening in China, I find full on unbelievable, that they have they're lifting almost 50 million people per year out of abject poverty and a subsistence existence of a dollar a day. And they're creating jobs, and they're coming to the cities, and there's a middle class that is emerging, and it's fantastic. What you saw at the Olympics was not a facade. I mean, that's who that country is and who they're becoming. And so where is the land of opportunity? I believe the land of opportunity is where you are. And what I mean by that is where you choose to be. And I think you can grow your roots where you choose to be. The demographics are, even though the near term it's hard. I don't mean to try to imply that it is not. Near term it's hard. I mean, we hired 40,000 people last year. We'll hire 30,000 people this year. That's hard. Some people have hiring freezes. We're destroying jobs. It's hard. But the long-term demographics are in your favor, and they're definitely in your favor in Western Europe. Because as those economies continue to grow, we're not replacing, there's not a system to replace knowledge workers in Europe. Because of the birth rate, the actual population in Europe is going down. And so you either have to have immigration, or you have to decide that you're going to be content with dramatically lower GDP performance, or you're going to have to believe you can move the productivity up dramatically to be able to keep those economies on track with the U.S. as well as on track with Asia. But I think there are opportunities everywhere. China is one of those places where I think it is very exciting what's happening there. But I think there are great opportunities in Western Europe. I love my Belgian partners. I've been to their partners meeting 3 or 4 times. I love them. I love spending time with them. And I'm going to be with my partners in Luxembourg next Thursday, and I'm going to be with my partners in Italy next Friday, and I'm going to be in the UK next Tuesday and Wednesday. And it's great. This is a great world, and the diversification of the economy is terrific. And it isn't negative that there are some economies that are catching up to the U.S. That's positive. And frankly, that's been enabled by the U.S. And I think the diversification of the economy is going to continue. But the other thing that is also very real, and the events of the last 6 months have made it brutally clear, is this economy is interdependent and interconnected. And the financial system that underpins it is absolutely fundamental to the ability to keep it moving forward. But I think there are wonderful opportunities everywhere. And do I think there are opportunities in the U.S.? Absolutely. Do I think there are opportunities in China? Absolutely. But just recognize, when you go to China, you're going to be competing with 1.3 billion people for that seat. And just think about the Deloitte recruiting team and 25,000 resumes. And those aren't just any 25,000 resumes. Those are brilliant people, really well educated. Other questions?
Yes. I'm a finance major. And it seems like with finance and accounting, there can be some opportunities or some decisions that companies can make that can be more dishonest. With your company, do you feel like the companies that you are competitive with, do you feel that dishonest decisions that they might make, do you feel like that, do you feel like it's hard to run with them, or do you feel like honesty makes you a step above them with the honest policies that you use?
The latter, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't even, it isn't hard for me to think about that at all.
But I'm just curious, because why would these companies decide to make those choices then?
The thing that I'm struggling with is the fundamental thesis of your question, but I think if I understand it correctly, you're suggesting that in finance it might be possible to sort of, you know, step across the line a little bit, and the temptations might be high because you're very near cash, and cash creates a motive for sometimes behavior that isn't necessarily consistent with what we might all think about. I won't use the name because I don't think it's appropriate, but I was at a leading institution, and I was asked in a setting not unlike this, whether you needed to be a different person on Sunday than you were on Monday through Friday. And if the only way to succeed, and that in order to really truly succeed in finance, was you had to be willing to step across the line. So you lived your life across the line Monday through Friday, acting in a dishonest way, taking advantage of people, providing only partial information to them in transactions, and just fundamentally stealing their money. And then on Sunday, you go to church, you're really a nice guy. And then on Monday, you begin living across the line again. And I just reject that thesis. And if anyone finds themselves in that position, the smartest thing you should do is resign. Life is way too short. Life is way too short to live your life in that fashion. And I absolutely do not attach to my competitors a label that I think they are not supportive of values. I feel like I'm a member of a profession, and I'm proud of that. And I respect my competitors, and I compete aggressively with them to beat them, but I don't spend time trying to say that I'm more holy than they are. And I totally reject the thesis that to succeed in finance requires you to be willing to step across the line. I just simply fundamentally reject that. Because what happens if you are told something by someone that you don't trust because you had a bad transaction with them one time? One of two things is going to happen. Either A, you will never do business with them again, likely, or B, if I ever do business with that person again, I'm going to work very hard to make sure that I have monitoring in place to know whether he's lying to me, and I'm going to ask 16 people the same question I asked them before I act on their advice. Now, if you have an advisor you can trust, or you have an advisor that you feel a need to ask 16 people whether or not they're lying to you or not, who are you going to deal with? And that's why I reject the fundamental thesis that long-term sustained success is available to those who figure out how to bend the rules and step across the line, and that they end up winning the long-term game. The only game they win is the short-term game. And that house of cards falls, ultimately. How did Bernie Madoff keep that going for as long as he did? Mysterious to me. When you, with the clear vision hindsight provides, you look back and you can see all of the warning signs. And then, why would BlackRock not deal with Bernie Madoff? Why would J.P. Morgan Trust not deal with Bernie Madoff? Why would Merrill Lynch not deal with Bernie Madoff? Why would Goldman Sachs not deal with Bernie Madoff? And the list goes on. And it just became brutally obvious to them when they sat down and spoke with him and asked him what he was doing, it didn't make sense to them. And they said, Bernie, thank you very much, good luck, and they left. They didn't put one nickel with him. And he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. And I'm sure had some lovely country clubs, but he has to be enormously embarrassed, as is his family disgraced. And there's no long-term success there. The only long-term success is one that is built in a principles-based way and in an ethical-based way. And that's the only basis on which you can actually compete in a sustained way. I totally reject the thesis that to succeed in finance, you've got to be willing to take advantage of people, to lie, to cheat, to give them half the information, to take their money and run. There's nothing sustainable about that. We've chewed up the time that was allotted to us. I appreciate the privilege of spending some time with you. This has been fun for me. I've gotten a kick out of this. I've never been here before. And I'm impressed by what is collected here and by what you are seeking to accomplish. And I hope that you have a sense of optimism and a sense of confidence in who you are and what's available to you and the enormous opportunities that you enjoy as a product of having the privilege of spending some time here. So thank you very much.